8 p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
And live from our national studios here in Accra, and also networking all our regional FM stations, we welcome you to Behind the News once again, the news and current affairs program where we examine the issues from the perspective of those making the news and also the experts. My name is Kingsley Odinchere. For tonight's edition, Ghana Integrity Initiative 2011 survey on corruption indicates corruption is still rife in government institutions and Ghanaian society. Have we just been lip service to in dealing with corruption? And should NP's common fund be channeled through chiefs? Well, the view of one chief is that it will ensure effective monitoring. And are we running out of LPG again? And is it even advisable to store the product at home? We'll be exploring all these issues. As Behind the News, and as usual, we're taking your text and comments on 026-441-8767. 026-441-8767. And we want to move on to our first story. If the recent findings on the perception of corruption by the Ghana Integrity Initiative is anything to go by, then corruption is still rife in the Ghanaian society. Institutions that are perceived to be corrupt are the very ones that citizens trust to address the problem of corruption. The report states that corruption has increased over the last 3 years, with key public institutions such as the police, the executive, parliament and the judiciary being ranked high on the corruption index. This might, however, be contrary to claims that corruption has been dealt with in society and key government institutions. Is there much talk on corruption than real action being taken to uproot it? Are the authorities just paying lip service to fighting corruption? Behind the News digest these issues. And we have joining us on the line for us to start this, Mr. Vitus Azim, Executive Director of Ghana Integrity Initiative. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Yes, we are returning to the issues again after looking at the global corruption perception. But what is the real situation as painted by your Ghanaian report?
Well, the situation as painted by our own survey, which was a nationwide survey, is that corruption is a serious problem. If you survey 2,096 respondents, and 92% of them, 9,936, say that corruption is a serious problem, then it's something that you need to really think seriously about if you are in power and in a position to deal with corruption.
Yeah. So you are telling us that a chunk of the people are of the opinion that certainly corruption is something that is still a big problem here.
Yes.
About how many in terms of percentage?
Yeah, 92.4%.
92.4. What did they point at directly to show that we still have some corruption here?
We just ask you a simple question. Is corruption a serious problem in this country? Yes or no? And 92.4% said yes.
Yeah.
And we had given, we started by defining corruption so that people know what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And what definition did you give?
People in using public, your entrusted power or position of power to your personal advantage. And personal advantage includes not just you as an individual, but your family, relatives, tribe, and political relations.
So, having known this, sometimes when you come out with this survey report, you put it as perception. So, did the people really have a direct impact on them with the corruption? Or sometimes they hear that, oh, I heard from a family member or perhaps from a friend. So, it's an extended perception.
There were some questions that sought to ask perception, but there were some direct questions.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there was a question, in the past 12 months, have you had contact with a number of institutions? If you had contact with a number of institutions, let's say the police or the education sector, mm-hmm. you have to pay a bribe. And so it came out that, yes, those who had contact, various people who had contact with the various institutions that were listed also said they had to pay a bribe. For example, 78.8% of the people who had contact with the utilities, and when we're talking about utilities, we're talking about water and electricity, 78.8% of those who had contact with them said they had to pay a bribe. Education and health sectors, 64.8% of the people who contacted them had to pay a bribe. The media, 63.7% had to pay a bribe. Ghana Revenue Authority, 44% of those who contracted had to pay a bribe. The police, 46.2%, and the private sector, surprisingly, even the private sector, people who had contact with the private sector, 37.9% of them said they had to pay a bribe. So this is not perception. This is people who actually had to do something with these people, like you want admission for your child in school, or you fall sick and you rush to hospital and you have to pay a bribe. It's actual situation. It's not just perception.
Yeah. Let me ask, the media, even before we start looking at others, what exactly did they do in terms of the bribe?
Well, unfortunately, we did not ask what they actually did. We just asked, did you make a contact? Yes. Did you have to pay a bribe? They said yes. The nature of the bribe, we didn't ask. And what they did, we didn't ask.
Perhaps, maybe with later studies, you'll be trying to find out the nature of it. But we are examining...
This may be a weakness in the
yes.
case, but we didn't ask for a reason.
Uh-huh. We are discussing this with the background that there's been efforts within the system to ensure that at least we reduce corruption to the barest minimum. How then do you assess the efforts put in place so far?
Well, when you say we've reduced corruption to the barest minimum, I don't know what we've done to reduce corruption to the barest minimum.
Well, we are talking about efforts put in place to try to reduce it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We've put in place some laws. Even the laws we've put in place, there are gaps. For example, the Right to Information Bill has been pending for almost 10 years now. Why are we not passing it? Then you look at the Asset Regulation Law, which was passed in 1998. Up to now, we don't have regulations on it. What is the essence of an Asset Regulation Law? If people would just declare their assets, put in an envelope and give it to the Auditor General to put, he has no right to open it and see whether it is a blank sheet of paper or it contains something. Even if it contains something, the Auditor General has no power to check and see whether you put that you have two houses, whether you really have those two houses or not. So even the laws that we have in place, there are gaps in them which we need to fill. But secondly, even the laws in place, they are not being enforced. In this year, we are in December, from January to December, how many corruption allegations as published in the newspapers have been investigated and the results made public?
Sometimes the other part of it is that he who alleges must prove. Were there questions to ask that perhaps for those alleging, especially with a lot of the newspapers that we find, it is not just mudslinging, but ensuring that you pursue it to its logical conclusions?
Yes, we asked a question as, do you report corruption to the authorities? And 1,461 respondents who said they had paid a bribe in the last 12 months said they did not report, and they gave various reasons why they did not report. 349 said, oh, it's a waste of time to report. 274 respondents said, oh, it will take too much time to get a solution. So in all, 623 respondents, out of those, the 1,600, that's just a bit less than half, said they did not report because it would be a waste of time. But then another 104 respondents said they did not even know where to file a complaint. And 161 respondents said they tried to make a complaint, but they were frustrated. While 212 respondents said, well, they feared that there will be reprisals. In other words, they will probably run into problems if they try to report. So yes, some people reported, some people did not report because they just thought, they have lost confidence in the system. So if you report, you're just wasting your time, or you won't get any redress.
Yeah. Mr. Vitas, I think we'll please hold you on the line for a moment as we get to the other line. And joining us is Benjamin Achina-Brentu, an aide to the Deputy Chief of Staff and also a member of Government's Communication Team. Good evening, Benjamin.
Good evening, and good evening to Vitas. Good evening to your listeners.
Yes, certainly, you've been following the report as it was released. Coming from the government side, how did you receive it?
Well, the government is very much concerned about the subject of corruption. So to that extent, anybody that is interested in how best we can all fight it, we welcome it. It looks as if the government as a whole and the Ghanaian public in general would have to educate itself more and more by the indices and the benchmarks that are used by this particular agency to deal with it. But that's notwithstanding, we can on our own speak to what we've been able to do as an agency. The important thing is that corruption and fighting it is an issue of putting in place systems to deal with it. So therefore, it is remarkable to understand that it is not possible for outcomes of systems that have been put in place to all of a sudden change their results once a new government comes in place. What I'm just saying is that if the police institution is corrupt, its shroud is corrupt, if there are corrupt bureaucracies in the ministries and agencies over the years, it will not take the entry of another government for all of these agencies to refine themselves. So therefore, if corruption perception in there still persists, they may as well be outcomes of years of systems that have been put in place that continue to give us these indications, which we still need to check as an agency. What major corruption issues which have bedeviled this government since our inception have been the issue of the Mutaka and the Mabe and Johnson issue, which of course the government responded to. Unfortunately, at the periods of this survey, those subjects have already been captured. What I'm just saying is that the Mabe and Johnson and the Mutaka incident, which were major issues and which happened previously, but it came up during our tenure in 2009, was not captured particularly by this survey. So what we would just want to find ourselves or apprise ourselves to, what were some of the significant issues which happened in the period 2010 to 2011 for which the survey is supposed to have been dealt with? Traditional institutions like police service, which many people believe have some elements of corruption in them, we've seen them having an IGP who is so much against the menace and have declared war to harvest to deal with it. Agencies like SHRAD, agencies like the IOCO, government has shown its full support to make sure that any effort that they are involved in to deal with the subject of corruption see the day of light. Again, we are also very much satisfied with the kind of personality the president brings on board. People both within and outside his government attest to the fact that he is not somebody who will necessarily condone acts of corruption. Like the question you asked, Mr. Vitus Azim, allegations of corruption, I'm sure, have come up. Recently, they are discussing NDC putting up a $20 million headquarters. Will that feed into some of these perceptions? And once those feed into those perceptions, will that necessarily make it true? For example, we have heard that Trasaco was building for the president. It turned out to be a hoax. We've also heard that deputy ministers of information were buying buildings outside of the country. They all turned out to be a hoax. So the point is that people throw a lot of issues out there, but refuse to put allegations, refuse to back them with facts. Those fit into the perceptions of corruption. But at the end of the day, how many of these things are really the truth?
Yeah. Benjamin, yes. I just want to ask here. People trust the executive to take action whenever issues of corruption come up, even though it is suspected that he who is alleging must also be proven. But what efforts is the executive putting in place or having in place to ensure that at least, even if the people do not support it with facts, it is investigated and then it is put out there that these issues were raised, it's been delved into, and these are the results? Don't you think it might even help the perception?
Yeah, precisely. You are in the media, so you may tell me what are some of the issues for which were so pertinent and you feel the government have ignored them. As far as we as a government is concerned, we are very much satisfied with our approach to corruption. And I refer specifically to how best we have been able to revamp anti-corruption agencies like SHRAD and also the IOCO. And they are doing marvelously well. And I think to that extent, we need to commend it. But also important to understand that our own record, as far as the Corruption Perception Index is concerned, is not too discouraging. Last year, for example, we had the best record in the last two decades. This year, the record for which many people are talking about, incidentally, happened to be the best record which was chalked under the last regime. It could have been far, far better, and we all strive to achieve that. But we do not have to be too critical on ourselves, particularly when the indices for which we are speaking to is a point of corruption which may not necessarily be actual incidents of corruption, but the perception based on reports, based on allegations. And it even goes further. It's not only limited to government corruption, because from what Mr. Vitus is speaking to, you realize that it even borders on private individuals.
I was coming to that one with Mr. Azim.
Is extended to them or not.
Yeah, so please hold on. That's one issue I wanted to go to quickly with Mr. Vitus Azim. Mr. Azim, this particular issue, especially with the private sector, it was expected that with that institution, at least, things will go overboard and not happen, and we won't have underhand dealings. What was happening there that really amounted to corruption?
Well, I as I said, we didn't ask for reasons. But as somebody working in the field who has been observing this, let's just look at a number of hotels. Most hotels in Accra now, always, when you go there for an event, they use the, let's say, they use the buffet style of giving you food. And a buffet from the outside world, you go and take as much as you like. But these hotels put girls around there at the back who determine how much you should take and eat. So you book about 50 people and you have only 20 people coming, and yet they are there to dictate how much they should give you. Is it not corruption? Why should they dictate how much you should eat? Why you are, I mean, buffet means you take as much as you want, whatever you want. So when you are talking about corruption, I think that we should not always look at NDC or NPP. This is a survey that covers the past 3 years, and it was conducted in April. So it covered part of NPP and part of NDC. So we should not look at it like, it's not like targeted at NDC, no. And also, it doesn't look at just the government, like the executive alone. It looks at other institutions, including the private sector, civil society groups, religious groups, and all that. So let's look at it from that point. And nobody is saying that the government is not doing something about corruption. It's doing something about corruption, or it has done certain things about corruption. Unfortunately, these things are not perceived by the society, the citizens, as successful.
Yeah. So what do you suggest?
As a politician, be worried about what citizens think about what you are doing. Because we'll soon be going into elections. So that is how we should look at it. Let's do more. This report just says that government has not done enough. It needs to do more. And they should accept it and do more.
Okay. So we're asking from the integrity initiative perspective, what do you think should be put in place to make the effort more steady?
Yes, one, you see a lot of allegations in the newspapers and on air about corruption. We expect government to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if I make a complaint, I'm an ordinary citizen, I don't have the mechanisms to investigate, but I make the investigation, I make the allegation. You should now, if it's credible, you should now investigate further. Because you can command people, you can access records, the government has put in place institutions to do that. So you do that. But if you don't do that, or if you politicize it, for example, these days a lot of things BNI takes up, and people have seen BNI more or less as a wing of the government or the security agency. But if you give it to CID and you follow up to make sure that they investigate, you might not politicize as much as they would do if it's BNI. Maybe this is not right, but people tend to see any BI arrest as political.
Even if it may be justified.
Yes, even if it's justified, people see it as political. And so people match up to BNI, especially if the person belongs to the other party. And we have to stop politicizing corruption. It is a serious problem in this country, and we must stop politicizing corruption. An individual decides to steal money, and then the political party comes to defend the person. That is not right. So it's not just the government in power at the time, but we must all are citizens of this country.
Yes.
If we are patriotic, look at it from that point of view, that individual is trying to steal resources from the state, depriving people of hospitals and drugs and good roads. You see a road, there's a road I don't want to mention the Facebook place. Three months now, there are already potholes on that road. And if the contractor has been paid, should it be a partisan thing? An engineer supervised the construction of that road.
Well,
if you want to curb corruption, let's leave out the political side of it.
Okay.
Unless you are saying that the parties are benefiting from the poor, shoddy work.
Mr. Vitus Azim, we want to thank you very much for your time this evening. Savitas Azim is the executive director of the Ghana Integrity Initiative. But Benjamin, were these suggestions, or don't you think so?
Yeah, I support the fact that everything within our means, as a people, as a government, as civil society, as media group, must be done to deal with the menace of corruption, because it hurts everybody in the final analysis. The truth also is that when a government have done well, it is important that we do commend it. And significantly, if you look at this report, what has come out, as has been painted by people who have commented on it, suggests that the government is corrupt, or more or less is not doing much to deal with corruption. Unfortunately, the outcome of the report, 3.9, stands to be the best performance over the last 8 years of the MPP. We build on it to a maximum degree, which needs to be supported.
Okay.
But we can do very little if people keep throwing allegations which are not true anyway, and people hold the perception that based on those allegations, people are corrupt. The Right to Information Bill, which Mr. Azim spoke to, of course needs to be passed. When this government came, it was at the level of cabinet and the executive level. We've been able to facilitate it, and it is currently in parliament. We expect parliamentarians to also do their part of it. That cannot be government negligence to that measure. The president himself opens up to be checked when he goes to the airport. He organizes sporadic checklists at the Tema Harbor and also at specific state agencies. We collaborated with ANAS, a private investigator, to make sure that people within government who were doing things we were not comfortable with were brought up to book. We have never interfered in the court system or have done anything to shield it.
So you believe that
only people have real incidents of corruption, but with this government have been reluctant on it, it will be interesting to bring it up.
Okay.
The government will take issues with it immediately.
Benjamin, we want to thank you very much too for being part of the show tonight.
Thank you.
Benjamin Achinabrento is an aide to the Deputy Chief of Staff and also member of the government's communication team. But one of the institutions that has featured on the Corruption Perception Index for some time is the Ghana Police Service. They've been doing so much, they will tell you, but what is Ali, and why is it that they are still regularly represented on a league table that is not so honorable? DSP Sifas Atta is Acting Director of Police Public Affairs, and he's on the line with us. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Kingsley.
Yes, you always like to query why people say the police is so corrupt. What do you say of this report?
Well, as a matter of fact, before I even start, let me say that I haven't laid hands on a copy of the report yet. So I'm going to comment based on the bits and pieces that I've been hearing on the airwaves and the media.
Mm-hmm.
It is very unfortunate that at this time, when the police service, and for that matter, the police administration is doing everything possible to bring the performance of personnel of the service to the level appreciable and comparable to all, I mean, the best practices internationally, people are still rating the Ghana Police Service as the most corrupt institution in the country. I think that they are only, to the best of my understanding, they are only recycling a mere perception. I say this because of the effort the police administration has made over the past couple of years, and is still making to purge the service of the few miscreants who have found themselves into our fold and are throwing pieces of mud at our image.
Mm-hmm.
If I would say anything, the first instance that I would want to cite to support this assertion is the image cleansing campaign that the Inspector General of Police himself and his administration launched in the year 2010, which is aimed at weeding out these miscreants, those people who have found themselves into our food and are tarnishing our image. And we can all Ghanaians are witnesses to the achievement that this campaign has chalked. Sometimes the administration is so stern and strict on its own that some members of the public have had a cause to blame the police administration for being high-handed on their own, or on its own. I must say that it's not as if we are only paying lip service to image cleansing. We are all witnesses. We parade them sometimes by the means of putting them in the newspapers and putting them before the screens, the lenses of their camera. And some people have had the cause to say that, oh, this is not one of the best methods and other things.
Yeah. So you believe that a lot of the people who fall foul of your rules are dealt with?
Exactly.
But do we get to the end? Sometimes it is when they are apprehended that we get to know that, oh, these ones were apprehended. But no one gets to know the conclusion of it.
It's unfortunate. In fact, it is something that we're just about hitting the airwaves with, as far as the results of the inquiries and the investigations that we've conducted into the conduct of some of these police officers over the past 2 years. But we realize at the point that we're just about to put it out, it was very, it will not be the best, because we are now concentrating our attention on Xmas security to assure the public. So we have put it on hold for now until early next year, when we are finished providing the people of Ghana the kind of security that they need to celebrate the Xmas, and then we'll show it to the public as to what we have been doing to them.
Yes.
It's not as if we have not been telling the public the outcome investigations at all, except that it has not been done regularly.
So
we are going to satisfy them on that score. And then we also say that other measures the police administration has put in place to ensure that we show up our image, we show up our performance, is the training and retraining regime that this police administration has introduced. Hitherto, we didn't have regular training for our personnel who have passed through the training schools and are now working. Over a long period of years, they will be working without any refresher course. And in that regard, everybody will believe, will accept, will bear with us that the police officer will go rusty and sometimes misconduct himself.
Okay.
But now the administration has introduced regular training and retraining, and at regular intervals, you see police officers of all ranks, taking 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 month courses at the police training schools and at various places.
DSP is a facata, and I always raise this question. I say that when we work with the top brass, you interact with them, you get to the ground with them, you realize that this is professionalism at its acme. And yet you get to the lower levels and you see that some of these ones who should be emulating the examples are also showing what you may not be very proud of. So what do you do to ensure that at that level where they regularly interact with the people, something positive is happening?
Let me say with all certainty that it is the younger ones that some people think are dragging the image of the service in the mud, who are actually performing the police work for which we are all glow-lit, for which we also praise the police. And let me say that it's just a few of them, a small percentage of them, whose activities have been dragging the name of the service in the mud, and that a large number of them are being what is expected of them.
Okay.
And so we cannot say that, oh, everything is the lower ranks or the junior ranks, they are
bad.
Doing everything.
Okay.
But then they are, by and large, they are doing the actual police work.
Okay.
Those of us at the upper part are supervising. Our role is also very crucial, but we are doing the supervisory.
DSP Sefasata. we know that they will be taking a look at this report and also giving the image. We are always looking, and what is good will come in, because we found a few too in these times who are also doing very well, even though they are still in the lower ranks. But for now, I want to thank you very much for your time.
I'm glad.
DSP Cephas Asa is Acting Director, Police Public Affairs. It's Behind the News, and you are live on Radio Ghana, Radio BAR Sunyan, Garden City Radio, Twin City Radio, Radio Central. If you are somewhere around calling Kwantania Koforidua, you are getting us live on Sunrise FM. Behind the News, so live on Ubuntu 96.5 FM and Unique 95.7. Some of your tests here. President Mills' regime was corrupt. Nana Savers 2012 MPP all the way. Victor, UDS. Victor, you heard Mr. Vitus Azim talking about the fact that politicizing it spoils the issue. And Mohamed Nani Inwa, if the government can reduce the current high corruption in Ghana by just 40%, single spine pay policy can be sustained. Behind the News, you're live on Volta Star Radio. Behind the News, you are still live on Ura Radio, Radio Upper West, and also on Radio Savannah. Reports of shortage of liquefied petroleum gas has been rife for some time. Some users of the product have complained that some filling stations claim they have run out of gas and their supplies have been irregular for some time. Is the alleged shortage real, or perhaps due to panic buying in some areas? How advisable is it for LPG to be stored in homes, looking at the dangers that it can pose? Behind the News takes a trip into the fears of consumers, and joining us on the line to examine the issues is Yaro Kasambata, Public Relations Officer of the National Petroleum Authority, NPA. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Yes. Yaro, are we running out of LPG again?
Not at all.
Then why are we having complaints?
Well, I mean, the information we are gathering is that, well, these are a couple of isolated, you know, cases. You can have a station running out of LPG. It is normal, okay, for a station to run out of LPG. But we have to go beyond just the station claiming that they have short LPG or there's no LPG on the market. They have to tell the individual what are the, you know, the causes of these shortages, okay? Because you can have more than one reason why a station will run out of LPG. One of it would be, for example, that particular station may owe the oil marketing company or may owe the supplier or the dealer. Sometimes they all send their request at a time, and the dealers are not able to meet all of them by the expected deadline or by the expected schedule. One of the other reasons is that sometimes a dealer who is a normal businessman will take decision based on, you know, what makes business sense to him. If I have to supply from Tema all the way to, let's say, a station in Brunghafu, and I have another obligation to supply down Sumana, Sherman, and let's say Kanda, if the prices and the consumption are all the same, why should I travel all the way to, you know, wrong half way if I'm a dealer and supply, when I can do Kanda, Dansuman, and, you know, a shaman and just get away with it?
Yeah. But,
because these are decisions that every business person will take. For
yeah.
example, you know, a radio station can decide, are you going to hold an outdoor event for this program, or you want to do it in your studio? Because either way, you are still going to bear some cost. Doing it in your studio is using existing structure, so you don't pay. But if you're going to do it outside, you're going to have to incur cost. So you do your cost-benefit analysis, will determine which step to go. These
yeah.
are normal decisions that business people
okay.
make.
Okay. Yeah, you've mentioned the business decisions that are so vital, but assuming it's one or two filling stations, is it not likely to start pressing the panic buttons and then, you know, the way people rush because somebody has said, we are running out of gas again?
Well, it is possible that some consumers may also resort to panic buying. What we are saying at this stage is that there is no LPG shortage in the country.
Mm-hmm.
As I speak to you now, Ghana has enough stock in our storage to at least accommodate our peak consumption for 1 week. So we cannot have LPG shortage now. We cannot. If there are isolated cases of shortages in stations, those can be investigated to know what are the real causes, those peculiar cases. But as a country, there is no shortage of the product.
You mentioned 1 week, and assuming that you know the way things go and vehicles are also using it, people will be traveling much more around this period. Does that mean that it's likely to also run out, assuming people decide to?
No. I mean, what we have said in the past is that at any stage, our national capacity can hold us for a little over a week.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, so that is your national capacity.
Yeah.
And so I'm telling you right now, what we have is what the country can store for at least a week, and that is your national capacity.
Good. The last time you mentioned the issue of the gantry and discharge, what has happened so far since we left off and we were supplied with adequate LPG?
Well, I mean, we are still working on, you know, expanding these things. You know that if you want to, looking at the way the facilities are working a tight schedule, if you have to shut them down for an expansion program or shut them on the line to work on this, you're going to have chaos on your hands, because it is the only place you're going to have to rely on for the same, you know, supply. So the idea is that when the fuel trades facility in terms is completed, you can use that one as a buffer, but perhaps you start working on this one. And so these are all decisions that are on the drawing board, and they are being looked at closely. Work is being done to make sure that we don't get to this particular position soon.
How soon do you expect work to be completed here?
So, I mean, these are not, you know, scheduled programs that I have on my hands right now. At least I can assure you that we have given ourselves between now to the end of first quarter to make sure that the fuel trade facility in Tema is completed. I can refer to all the other programs and, you know, give it to you later, but I don't have it in offhand.
Right.
I know by end of first quarter, fuel trade should at least finish their storage and loading gantry ready for use.
Okay, so the assurance is that during this holiday period, the country is not running out of LPG. Is that it?
I can assure you during this holiday season, there will not be shortage of LPG.
We want to thank you very much for your time, Yaru.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yaru Kasambata is Public Relations Officer of the National Petroleum Authority. But talking about LPG and its storage, especially around this time, it can have its dangers. Billy Anaglati is with the Ghana National Fire Service and has joined us on the line. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
What is that danger with storing LPG?
Yes, if we are talking about LPG storage, then all of us must be conscious. But we are looking at a very volatile substance. LPG, for instance, when people are said to be storing LPG, first of all, we look at the domestic storage, where people, as of today that we are talking, there are people that are having the cylinders stored in their kitchen. We advise severally that it is wrong to have a cylinder stored in your kitchen because of the expansion nature of the gas itself. LPG has a rate of 250 times the volume that comes out of the cylinder. That if you have 1 liter of LPG out of the cylinder, you should expect 250 times volume that would increase. Because it is heavier than air, it is able to travel from the kitchen to whatever a naked fire is big, and it will definitely bring fire into the home. Apart from that, when it is said that there's going to be shortage, we also see people buying a lot of LPG in their cylinders, in their storage, even in their homes, at times people, even in their bedroom. What the situation is that because some of the people do not have proper storage capacity, they try to push LPG even under their beds and they turn the cylinder. When you turn the cylinder, LPG stored under pressure is liquid within the bottle. So when you let the cylinder lie parallel on the floor, you are putting pressure on the valve that is in the cylinder. And by doing that, the pressure can also force the valve out and there could be a leakage in the room that could still cause fire.
Yeah.
So we are saying that storage of LPG, all of us must be able to do it properly and ensure that cylinders are stored at the open air, so that when there is a leakage, we expect the oxygen or air to dissipate the concentration of the LPG to prevent fire.
Yeah. So assuming you have some at home, what should you regularly be doing?
If you have, even if you have the cylinders,
yes, filled cylinders.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. If you have the cylinders at home, what we expect that the cylinders must be stored outside the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Preferably, it will be within an open air, so that when you even have the leakage, the air or the wind would dissipate the concentration of it. That's okay. Why we advise that you can make a cage or whatever behind your kitchen where the cylinder itself will be there. Then you can connect it with the hoses to the cooker in the kitchen. What normally happens is that even if you are in the kitchen and you are cooking and there is fire in the kitchen, definitely every normal human being will run out of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get out of the kitchen, you run outside where there's going to go off.
Okay.
That is the first point of trying even to fight that fire.
Okay.
But when it's in the kitchen, you are out of the kitchen, it will be difficult for you to get into the kitchen to turn the cylinder off. That is why the fire will rage and engulf the whole premise.
Yeah, so it means it's just turning it off. Otherwise, you can't do anything if there is a fire.
No, when we are talking of gas fire, it is something that is so difficult,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, unprofessional, like any individual will find it difficult to handle. The best you can do is that when the cylinder is outside the kitchen, then you would be able to turn it off. When you turn it off, the energy that fire needs to be sustained is taken off.
Yes.
So even before you call the fire service, before we get there, unless otherwise you have other combustible materials close to that fire, that could sustain the fire. Else, if it's only on the cooker and the gas supply is turned off, that fire could easily go on by itself.
You've mentioned, for purposes of education, can you give us your numbers again in case of emergency?
Well, we have an emergency number which is 192. 192 is a toll-free number that we expect that anytime there is fire, anybody that calls 192 will assess the fire service.
Yeah.
Yes. And then, apart from that, with our headquarters, our SMC, that is the control room, we have 0302-772-446. 0302-772-446. So at least, if you are able to access these two numbers, normally what happens by people calling the fire service is that when you call, they call the fire service, they find it difficult to have time even to direct the fire service at the exact address of the fire. We expect that people should take their time to call the fire service and then give the proper address to it. Just tell us then any landmark, so that we would definitely be at that place. Because we are just getting to Xmas. And this is the time that everybody hopes to make merry with their family. But this is the time that we are seeing a lot of fires. This is the time that people even died in fire. This is the time that people property perish. Meanwhile, 99% of the fires that we fight are all preventable. So we are also saying that all those factors that lead to fire outbreaks are all preventable. But it is only a human factor. It is when you and I cultivate the fire safety culture that we will be able to prevent all these fires that are preventable.
We want to thank you very much, but we've not finished. We'll continue with the alerts in the course of this period towards the holidays. Thank you so much, Mr. Billy Anagladi.
Yeah, I'm also grateful for GBC giving us the opportunity once again to educate people and also to prevent fires in their homes and premises. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Behind the News, you are live on Ubuntu 96.5 and you are also on Volta Star Radio. We want to move on. The issue of MPs Common Fund at times generates heated debate between sitting MPs and district chief executives. Sometimes the MPs accuse the district chief executives of deliberately frustrating them when they want to access the Common Fund. With a suggestion by a traditional ruler that the MPs Common Fund be channeled through chiefs help save the situation, Well, the view of the Nungwa Mancha is that channeling the MP's fund through the chiefs will ensure effective monitoring and disbursement. What would the leadership of parliament make of this suggestion? We have joining us first to look at the issue, the majority leader, Mr. Cletus Abuka. Good evening, sir.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Do we really have a problem with effective monitoring of the MP's common fund?
Do I have a problem with?
The monitoring of the MP's common fund and as to how they are used.
I don't know whether you are talking about disbursement of the common fund.
Yes, when it has been disbursed.
You have to disburse before you monitor, you know.
Yeah.
No, I don't think that generally we have a problem. We have isolated cases of some members of parliament and some district chief executives on a coalition course as to the way the common fund, the MP's common fund should be used. But that is the exception rather than the rule or the practice. So we cannot use an isolated case of one or two constituencies to generalize for the 230 constituencies. So I think that to a large extent, all districts, all constituencies, MPs and district chief executives appreciate the intervention of the MP through the MP's common fund. And I don't think that we should have any problem about either disbursement or its monitoring.
Yes.
There are guidelines provided by the Ministry of Local Government and Rural Development as to how the common fund can be used. Generally, it is used to augment some of the projects that the district assembly is supposed to do. And then because the MP's common fund is very, very meager as compared to the district assembly's common fund that goes to the district, it is only intended to make some limited intervention in some very, very minor areas. And that is quite insignificant to as compared to the district assembly's common fund. So generally, I think that is a useful source of funding for interventions, and it should be maintained.
Yeah, with the chief trying to call for channeling through their institution, it means that perhaps they also have a problem with the MPs handling it, because they might think the MP will not be addressing their concerns. Do they really know what a fund is for? Do people have that education on it?
Well, it's difficult for me to say whether people have enough education on it or not. But from what the chief has said, it does appear to me that some people do not actually understand the purport of the MP's common fund. Now, let us go back to on the memory lane. Historically, until the promulgation of the 1992 Constitution or the Fourth Republic of Ghana, the MP was a pivot of development in the constituency. So if you take the First Republic, Second Republic, and Third Republic, the MP was identified or seen as a pivot of development in the constituency. And that brought about unbalanced development, because some MPs can be very proactive, some MPs could be resourceful and could meander their ways through, some MPs could be good lobbyists, and as a result of that, get projects for their districts. So at the Consultative Assembly, this was discovered, that to bring about balanced development and to ensure that there is real decentralization, it is important that we have a formula where 7% of the national cake will be distributed to the district assemblies on some formula. You have the what the formula includes, among other things, equalizing factor. It also has a factor that cuts across all the districts, and then responsiveness, and then pressure on the district, etc. So that was what happened. So with the introduction of the District Assembly Common Fund in 1993, the MPC is to be the pivot of development in the district. It is now the District Assembly, which is headed by the District Chief Executive with the support of the District Assembly members. That is why every year, the Minister of Local Government will come, and then with the formula, and the MPs will distribute the Assembly's Common Fund according to that formula to all metropolitan, municipal, and then district chief executives. So that is the thing. But because we also realize that some people are not still aware or are not still happy that the MP is not a center of development, not a pivot of development. So this MP's Common Fund, which is just about, sometimes it used to be about 300 Ghana cedis a quarter. Now it can rise up to about 10,000 cedis, Ghana cedis a quarter or thereabout. It's given to the MP to make limited intervention. Like if there is a rainstorm and then the school is roofed, and he just needs to buy a packet or two packets of roofing sheets. If some students are distressed, brilliant and needy students are distressed, you need intervention to pay school fees for them. Such similar situations. That's what the fund is meant for. It's not meant for big projects like building a school or constructing a road or bringing water unless it's a borehole or something. So that's the background.
Okay.
So,
for emphasis,
the elected representative of the people.
Yeah.
The chief is not necessarily an elected member. The chief is somebody who has been chosen by the kingmakers or the stool makers, and then made a chief. He cannot compare his position as that of the member of parliament who is elected by everybody in the constituency. The chief might want to be elected by kingmakers and by people who belong to the royal family.
Mm-hmm.
But the MP is elected by everybody in the area.
Okay.
So therefore, the MP certainly has a mandate and to represent the will and the wish of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, chiefs are also agents of development. And some chiefs have done this so successfully. You can take the Asante Hini, you can take Ichini Hini, and several others. You can take Nana Otuo Siribo, who celebrated 40th year in the office recently. They are bringing about development projects extra in their area, supporting students, you know, raising revenue or resources here and there to support. So that, to that extent, yes.
Some so in that case, the MPs can even liaise with them and just support them with their funds.
Yes, the MPs can team up with the chiefs and then make use of it.
Yeah,
now, in the constituency, you can have 2-3 chiefs. You can have 3-4 chiefs. Should this MP's common fund, that is, I'm saying, is very insignificant. Should they take that man and divide equally among the chiefs in the particular constituency? What effect will that have?
Okay. Yeah. So what is the amount now? You mentioned.
Let me add this point. Some chiefs, particularly in southern Ghana, have the benefit of a stool property and then get royalties.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the constitutional provision, there are royalties meant for the occupant of the stool and then also for the traditional area. And therefore, I think that they should make judicious use of those resources that are available to them rather than stretch a hand to what is given to the MP to support certain interventions.
Okay.
I think that they can complement each other.
Good. I was asking the amount presently.
Oh, it differs from quarter to quarter. It depends on how much money has been raised by the Minister of Finance and Economic Planning.
Okay.
As I said, it is about 7% of what the national cake is. So if the national kick is 1 billion, it will be 7% of that. If we are able to mobilize 2 billion or whatever, it is 7% of that. So it is not a fixed figure.
Yeah, okay. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Kletos Savoka, for your time.
Yeah, welcome.
That's the majority leader in parliament. But the chiefs trying to extend their influence into this area may also be talking of being involved so much in the democratic development of their areas. Paul Mensah Abrampa is Programs Officer with CDD. We want to look at this issue briefly. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, my brother.
You've heard the suggestion and you've heard the explanation by the majority leader on the issue. What do you see?
Well, I support the majority leader 100%. My basis, he is taking it from so many angles, so proven and then tested. My basis is on accountability level. As he said, you know, these funds, common funds, MP funds, all these things have methods and methodologies for ensuring that they account for every person that is taken from the corpus. And they are part and parcel of modern system of accountability, which the constitution enshrines and allow people, even within the constituency and the district, based on social accountability principles, to account to their people. These systems are there. In the traditional setup, we can't talk of better principles and measures of accountability in the traditional setup. When you talk to some chiefs, they will tell you they have the Nkwankwahine, they have the Mranchene, they have all these things there, but they are not accountable to anybody. As the majority leader said, chiefs are elected or nominated by a group of people who are kingmakers, and not the entirety of the people within the district. And in one district, you might have 3, 4, 5 chiefs who should take hold of the money. And more so, don't let's make mistakes. Chiefs also have access to some funds that they may or must use for development. They take royalties for development. And when you go on social accountability projects, you realize even these amounts are not being accounted for and there's nobody to hold them accountable. In the same vein, chiefs on one hand are claiming not to be infiltrated upon by the modern system. Even when you see the even chief issues, government has no direct interference or intervention in them unless we set special committee to look at it. So if you give them money for them to attend, who and where and how do we make sure our money are expended as we want them? So obviously, chiefs shouldn't be making claims of some of these things.
Yeah. So how will the MPs try to address their needs? Let them see that we understand your concerns. Here is the money, but we are all using it to our well-being as a constituency.
Well, MPs, the bill of the fund is used for emergency interventions, as the majority leader said. Setting up some small funds for scholarships, with uprooting, it's not any big thing. And also, some of these things, and even in the whole district assembly common fund, is done in consultation with chiefs after development. If I should give you the criteria through which district planning is done from the unit committee level to the constituents, to the chiefs and traditional people of a particular area that are consolidated into an annual plan of the district. So all the problems to these specific sectors in the district, from every traditional area, is embodied in the annual plan, and the money is used in doing that. The chief is supposed to live with the district assembly by releasing lands and also helping mobilizing his people, sometimes for self-help and communal labor. So the chief, even if the money is not given, based on this royalty and the command of people and land, is part of development in the area and is being recognized.
We want to thank you very much, Paul Abraham Pamensa, for sharing these ones with us too.
Thank you very much, my brother.
That's a program ourselves with CDD Ghana. And some quick tests before we go. Baba Musa UDS is saying, Mr. Vitus Azim should know that if judges themselves are corrupt, how can they do justice to corruption cases? Clearly, government is on course and fighting corruption. And Manuel in Banu, I hope I got that one right, is saying, corruption is really high in the country to the extent that small children are involved. How would the future of this country be? And it's asking whether we've really fought corruption very well. And that is where we wrap it all up for today. Nina Isowa sat at the controls for us. Jonathan Thompson did the summaries on behalf of the production team of Christopher Sidu, Bright Agama, and Abraham Asari. My name is Kingsley Obinchere.